This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
The world was stunned last week to find a small village of indigenous people had already performed a massive experiment off the Pacific coast of Canada. To no one's surprise, the so-called rogue climate hacker Russ George was a lead actor. How did the salmon beliefs of the Haida combine with the long-term dream of the former CEO of Planktos Corporation? Why would an economically challenged village of 700 people spend millions on a high-tech, high-risk venture? As nature shows signs of dying, we can expect more such acts of desperation. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. The old village of Masset is a region on the islands of Haida Gwaii, formerly the Queen Charlotte Islands. It's a hamlet where First Nations people suffer up to 70% unemployment for decades. The village straddles an opening, partly sheltered from some of the strongest storms in the world, washing the island rainforest much of the year. The Haida people were known as fierce warriors, making slave missions down the Pacific coast in their great seagoing canoes. They are still proud and respected in British Columbia, but the salmon have almost stopped coming. The salmon runs of Haida Gwaii are much more than the main source of food. There are salmon ceremonies, the most vivid, rich salmon art. The whole culture is infused with this emblematic fish. That is why one Haida village was willing to risk millions of dollars on a scheme mainstream science had already abandoned and formally condemned. The villagers were already dealing with one of the world's most persuasive men. He's a big dreamer, certain. He knows how to fix the world with limitless nuclear energy, with protected forests, or by conquering the oceans for humankind as new fields to be farmed. Russ George fought for years to mount an experimental ship, dumping iron into the open ocean to create a massive plankton bloom. He almost made it in 2007 with the Weatherbird 2. His company Planktos came tumbling down amid overblown claims that never materialized. Two needs, two dreams met. The Haida villagers set out to sea again, longing almost mystically to see the return of their salmon by feeding tons of iron as a stimulant to plankton. Russ George was on board the rented fishing boat Ocean Pearl, promoted to the title of Chief Scientist. But Russ George is not a scientist at all, as most people understand that word. He's a social artist, a mimic, almost a savant, maybe a visionary, but he is not a scientist, as I will explain. Were people misled? Was money misspent by a poor community? Is the world one step closer toward trying to redesign the land and the sea in the wake of industrial catastrophe? We'll hear the voices of those who were there and investigate some claims evaluated by real scientists. But I'm not going to demonize anyone here. These are human players with something to give us, some huge lessons written on the real living canvas of history. We are not talking about tobacco or oil barons killing millions of people for money, but rather well-meaning people who perhaps went too far. You will hear for yourself, and I've mounted an exhaustive written blog with lots of links for you to follow up further. It's at ecoshock.info. We will start with an extraordinary event. The unauthorized scheme to replant the ocean was uncovered by the ETC group while at an international conference on biodiversity in Hyderabad, India. Suddenly, on October 15th, the ETC group broke the story in the British Guardian newspaper. The Haida group involved and Mr. George were caught off guard. A storm of media broke upon the little island community. Representatives from the old village of Masset traveled down to Vancouver to face a solid wall of TV cameras, well-known national newspaper reporters, and this humble radio producer. I'm going to play you now my recording of old Masset chief Ken Ray and the village administrator John Disney at the press conference. It was October 17th in the Vancouver Aquarium, of all places. The event was hosted by Vancouver lawyer Joe Spears. I'll run this straight through, withholding my comments to the end.
Thank you, Dr. Nightingale, and it's great to be here at the aquarium. My name's Joe Spears, and I'm counsel with Straight Litigation, counsel for the Haida Salmon Restoration Corporation. We have a press release here this morning and a press conference. For some of those people that have come in, there is a backgrounder that will be passed out as well as an electronic media kit with a variety of information. The format is going to take the following. We have Chief Ken Ray, Chief Counselor of the Old Masset Council. We've got Mr. John Disney, President of the Haida Salmon Restoration Company, and James L. Straith, Counsel to the company, talking on some of the legal issues. Without further ado, I'm going to pass it over to Chief Ray. Each of the speakers is going to make a statement, and then we're going to open it up to questions, and I'll be moderating those questions. Thank you very much for coming here this morning. Chief Ray.
Thank you, Joe. Thank you for attending our press conference here at the Vancouver Aquarium. I am the elected chief counselor for the village of Old Masset. I am the lead spokesperson for our community, and I am the principal for this initiative. It has been quite an experience this week. It is clear that this has generated a great deal of attention both locally, nationally, and everywhere. I want to tell you a story in my own words. I am a leader, a businessman, a fisherman and a father, and a steward of our oceans, and I take these roles very seriously. We live in Old Masset and lived on the ocean for generations. We are stewards of the land and always taking a strong leadership position when it's coming to resource management and sustainable development. This is nothing new, and we've been here for generations, and we want to ensure in a healthy ocean for future generations. In recent years, something has changed in our oceans. The salmon are gone, and this has created many problems and has affected my people's and future and village's future. Unemployment in my village is over 70%, and economic opportunities are limited. The village council, it was clear we needed to take action to bring back the salmon, which are so critically important to our people. Our oceans and the salmon that was produced in the past has employed many in the fishery. That is no longer in the case. This has led to create the Haida Salmon Restoration Corporation. This is owned by our village. This is a Haida company that was tasked with helping examine our oceans and restore our salmon to be used by our people for food, ceremonial, and commercial purposes. The creation of this company and this project was consulted widely and discussed by many people in the community. It was not a decision taken lightly. We have an obligation to steward our scarce financial resources. We undertook the step of restoring the salmon in the ocean. We developed a company and a team to undertake this work. You'll hear much more from John Disney about the actual work this summer that utilized a research vessel, the Ocean Pearl, and a variety of the latest in technology. We did our due diligence. We looked at the science, the legalities, the practicalities, and we consulted, and then we implemented. Iron in the ocean is a natural thing. It is not as a pollution as some of the recent press have indicated. We went into the high seas to do this project because that's where the fish are. We are in international waters where the law of the sea convention governed. We undertook our work in the open ocean and collecting baseline data, more marine life was observed. As we collected data, we took steps for restoration. It wasn't long before we saw the results of the seabirds, whales, and fish. We collected all the data. When the Ocean Pearl returned to the dock, there is much work to be done. We need to analyze this data, and we are continuing to do that in accordance with normal scientific practice. Under the law of the Sea Convention, we have an obligation to undertake scientific research as a village as well share the data. We want to protect the ocean. We want to create a sustainable economy. We want to provide answers, and we want to help provide solutions. It may be that ocean carbon credits may be the way to do that. Only the data would tell. The success of our project will be measured when the salmon return to our waters. We believe in this project. We want to share this project and our findings with the broader community. It is our hope and that our investment is the right one for this community. On a changing planet, we need to take bold steps. The people of the village of Old Masset believe that we have taken the right step. Time will tell. Ho'a for honoring our invitation, and thank you for listening.
I'd like to now call on Mr. John Disney, the president of the Haida Salmon Restoration Corporation.
Thank you for all coming out to this conference here this morning. Our project has generated a great deal of media attention, both locally, nationally, and internationally. I want to tell you about the project, what we did, and how we did it. This project was not entered into lightly, and we have complied with all the necessary aspects of ocean governance before undertaking the work. But what I want to make very clear is we do not consider micronutrient replenishment of a naturally occurring substance to be pollution. We are using this for restoration purposes to restore the salmon back to their rightful place in the old masted economy. We have created a great team working to develop the knowledge that will allow us to have a sustainable future, and that is a guiding principle of the company. As president, I am very cognizant of all the requirements of the scientific and legal nature that applies to this project. I'd like to say at this time that the international media and national media seems to have focused on Russ George, who we brought in as our chief scientist. I want to make this emphatically clear. Russ George did not come to us to dupe us or sell us a bill of goods. We approached him, and we based that on 10 years of work with him in other fields. I've known Russ for over 10 years, and I'll tell you something that is very rare. He's never once lied to me. He's only told me the truth. He has great integrity, and he's never let us down. And every time he's told me something that I thought was unbelievable, I've checked it out, and he's always been right. And I challenge anyone else in the corporate world to come up with that about a person. Russ has one aim in life. He wants to try and make the planet a better place. That's it. I don't care what else you read. The full highlights of the process are set out in the background to the Haida Salmon Restoration Project, but I want to take you to a couple of points. We sought the best scientific method to ensure that our efforts and investment of more than $2 million would pay dividends in the future. We sought to use the very latest cutting-edge marine science technology to make this a reality. We used local people wherever possible. We consulted widely to a global scale, and we undertook all our due diligence. The Salmon Enhancement Pilot Research Project, also known as Ocean Restoration or Ocean Micronutrient Replenishment, was to study conditions of the ocean offshore west of Haida Gwaii, which we understood and believe act as a pasture for juvenile salmon. We wanted to examine this with a particular emphasis on the collapse of plankton biomass that traditionally provides nutrients to salmon and other marine life. The goal of our project was to restore the growth of phytoplankton, therefore sustaining and enhancing marine life. What is well documented in literature is the amount of iron dust entering the oceans has decreased over time. We thought there was a link between a recent volcanic eruption and an increase in returning salmon that was caused by the introduction of iron dust into the marine ecosystem of the Gulf of Alaska. One of our goals was to see if we could make that connection. In 2010, instead of the less than a million salmon returning to the Fraser River, there were 40 million. We had planned to release our information from our research after the Cohen report was set up by the Ministry of Fisheries and Oceans to examine the collapse of salmon stock. However, the recent article in the British Guardian and the resulting flurry of media attention put the spotlight on this project. And so we thought it best if we put some of the factual story, an amazing story, out to you so you could learn firsthand of what we found. An important thing to remember is that this story is ongoing. Pictures tell 1,000 words, and we have many, many pictures and thousands of words to tell. And what we found was, when we added iron into the ocean, there was an almost immediate observable impact on marine life, such as whales and other sea mammals, seabirds, pelagic fish. And this could all be observed immediately from the research vessel. This is encouraging, but until we analyze the data, we will not know the full results of our efforts. In your media package, we have both photos and information of our data collection techniques. We sought to use the latest in technology, using a solid approved methodology for collecting both the baseline data and to measure the potential increase in marine phytoplankton production. We collected an amazing amount of data in an area where there's been very little oceanographic research. The gyre where this work was undertaken appears to be very stable. Our next steps are the ongoing work to analyze the data. The ultimate proof will be in the return of sockeye salmon to our watersheds in 2014 and subsequent years. As our background indicates, we are going to release some of this data for independent third-party analysis. We also want to create a dialogue around this issue. I also want to make it clear that the work was performed in international waters, is lawful, and we sought legal advice from experienced maritime counsel who worked in this area for many years before acting. We have every intention of cooperating with Canadian government officials, and it has always been our position to comply with Canadian law, even when operating in international waters. In fact, up to 7 federal ministries know about or have been involved to some extent in this project. Our company is very hopeful that the salmon will return and we may be able to measure carbon, will be able to fund future restoration work. It might be hard for some of you to comprehend that a small First Nations community consisting of a few hundred people could undertake such a project. But I'll tell you that this isn't a single standalone project. Old Mastit has been observing the environment around them and been concerned about what they see and taken several steps in recent years. We have a state-of-the-art wastewater treatment plant, so our sewage is non-threatening to the surrounding environment. We've addressed the issue of throwing offal in the ocean from our processing plants, and now it is sold to local farmers who compost it, grow chickens and cows, from which we then buy that meat. We're embarking on an alternative energy plan to get off diesel generation. In fact, we're about to respond to our BC Hydro request for interest in proposals that's coming out next month. And we've set up one of the only radiation monitoring systems on a 24-hour basis in the northwest corner of BC. So this isn't a new area that we've entered. We are familiar with the routines and the rigor around doing scientific work. Thank you for coming here today.
You've just heard Old Mastit Village Chief Ken Ray and Village Administrator John Disney explain their venture to drop iron into the Pacific Ocean. They had two goals, to provide more food for salmon and to capture carbon dioxide and sell that as carbon credits. I must add, the main government on Haida Gwaii, the Council of the Haida Nation, has denounced any involvement in this scheme. In a letter published October 18, 2012, we read the following. The Hereditary Chiefs Council and the Council of the Haida Nation are in no way involved in artificial fertilization through dumping of iron compounds in the ocean around Haida Gwaii. The consequences of tampering with nature at this scale are not predictable and pose unacceptable risks to the marine environment. Our people, along with the rest of humanity, depend on the oceans and cannot leave the fate of the oceans to the whim of the few. End quote. It is signed by the president of the Haida Nation, Guja, and the 8 members of the Hereditary Chiefs Council. So it is unfair and incorrect to say the Haida did this. As Chief Ken Ray told the World Press, this experiment was undertaken only by a single village of Old Mastit, acting on its own authority. How could that happen? A little later we'll get an explanation of the politics of Aboriginal rights from none other than Russ George. It's an eye-opener on how this little group bypassed every Canadian authority, issuing its own permits almost as a sovereign village. Although, as you heard, they claim the Canadians knew all along. First, we have to take a look at the money trail. When asked where a tiny village with sky-high unemployment came up with $2.5 million for a high-seas adventure, this is what Chief Ken Ray said in the press conference Q&A. The CBC asked, whose money is it?
It's the community's money.
Well, the CBC followed up, from the taxes, from the government, or transfers? What's the biggest source of money?
We've had monies available from other funding sources that belong to the community. We've had money from proper management and shared revenue sources from various resources. And we've over careful management over many years, we've built up a reserve.
Considering the money belonged to the villagers, and some of it came from Canadian taxpayers indirectly, this is hardly a transparent answer. A Canadian ocean NGO, the Living Ocean Society, released documents from Masset Village and from the North Coast Community Credit Union detailing the application for a loan of $2 million for the Haida Salmon Restoration Corporation. Where did a village of 700 people find millions of dollars to pay for a complicated project of ocean geoengineering? Joining us now is Karen Riston, Executive Director of the Living Ocean Society based in British Columbia. Karen, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks very much.
Your organization received internal emails and financing documents for the old Masset Village. Can you tell us what you found?
We found that the credit union had been approached by the economic development officer, Mr. Disney, with a story that he was going to conduct an iron fertilization program in order to raise money by selling carbon credits.
And at the press conference October 19th, Old Masset Village Chief Ken Ray said they found over $2 million from reserves in various sources, although he wasn't specific. Yet you found their application for a loan from the North Coast Credit Union for $2 million. Did they borrow that money, and how much has to be paid back?
Well, I can't say that they borrowed the money. All I can say is that the document certainly indicates that the loan was granted. And if it was granted according to the terms that are contained in it, they were required to pay it back over 10 years, which would mean more than $250,000 a year in principal payments plus interest each year.
And the North Coast Credit Union appears to have done some due diligence in those documents, and they had some questions about Russ George and Planktos. Can you tell us about that?
They certainly did. Anyone who Googles Russ George will find that he has a great deal of ink to his credit, and the bank obviously did that. They were concerned about a number of the things that had been represented to them. The first and foremost, that the iron fertilization scheme as proposed was both legal and scientifically credible. They questioned that and all of the evidence that had been presented to them in support of that proposition. They also questioned concerning Mr. Russ George himself, the proponent of the project, whether or not his scientific credentials would be sufficient to enable anyone to verify that there were carbon credits to be offered from this project.
So it's your feeling from at least that loan application that they were going for the carbon credits as a money-making scheme rather than really going for enhancing salmon.
Yes, I'm sure they believed they were doing both. I can't imagine any Haida council doing anything that they thought would harm salmon. So I'm sure that it had been represented to them that this would be a collateral benefit of the project. But there's no question at all that at least in conversations with the credit union, the scheme was presented as a carbon credit sale.
Now, I'm going to ask you something you may or may not know about. It seems that the Haida had some money in a trust fund called the Gwai Trust, and that was proposed as collateral for this multi-million-dollar loan, whether that happened or not. Do you have any thoughts about that?
I've read the application that was made to the Gwai Trust Society Fund. That was also available online in order to support taking out that grant to cover off the project, and it's very poorly supported in terms of the intent of the project and how the project was meant to generate wealth to come back into the community.
Right, I've read those documents and I just didn't see a revenue stream coming back unless they could sell carbon credits, but the people that I've talked to and other reporters have suggested that there would be real difficulties selling carbon credits from a project based on what may be illegal geoengineering.
Not just there would be problems selling the carbon credits, it's flat out impossible. There's no one to verify that any carbon was sequestered. There's no market for them. It's just not going to happen. What's happened here is that some salmon who happen to be in the vicinity of the dumping have just been provided with a very expensive lunch. The jury's entirely out on whether or not that's going to result in an improved run of salmon. And if it does, I'm sure Mr. Disney will be taking credit. But to return the equivalent of $2.5 million wealth to the community, I'd say that is flat out impossible with one dump. This is a one-shot deal. It's not like the plankton bloom's going to regrow there every year. It only grows when you apply the iron. So it just doesn't pencil out, no matter how you look at it.
In your Living Oceans press release, you also report warning Environment Canada, the agency really responsible on the West Coast there, giving details of the ship name and where it was. Did they act on this information?
I have no information whether they acted on it or not. Certainly the local resident who had brought the matter to my attention in the first place did not see them take any action, and it would appear that they were able to continue to dump after the date that I reported it.
Is it possible the Canadian government was willing to let this geoengineering experiment go ahead despite having signed an international moratorium agreement against it?
That would seem to be the case.
Well, what is the position of the Living Ocean Society on artificial creation of plankton blooms by iron seeding?
We have no position different from that of the entire scientific community. There are two international scientific bodies that have looked at this and have reviewed the results of the several controlled experiments that have taken place, and they've concluded that there is at best a 50-50 chance of ever sequestering any carbon, and a huge collateral potential for actually robbing the ocean of oxygen and reducing marine biodiversity. So our position is it's clearly not a proven technology, and it simply should not be undertaken.
Okay. We've been talking with Karen Riston, Executive Director of the Living Oceans Society. Find out more at livingoceans.org. Thank you so much, Karen. As you can tell, there are still a lot of questions about the way this money was allocated, the wisdom of the expense, and whether these millions can ever be repaid.
Radio EcoShock.
Despite talking so much about salmon, which were certainly on the minds of most villagers when they voted, documents and interviews show the larger hope of repayment was to come from selling carbon credits. There is a theory that plankton will capture more carbon dioxide from the air when they're fertilized. Then on dying, that carbon will fall with them to the deep seabed, where it will be sequestered. If done on a large scale, this might somewhat reduce the carbon dioxide pumped into the air by us. More polluting industries, especially in Europe, will pay a price for each ton of carbon captured. As you will hear later, Russ George has 100% certainty creating plankton blooms does capture carbon dioxide. And now he claims this later venture proves it beyond any doubt. The fact that Russ George does not express scientific caution and has never published any peer-reviewed proof of his claims is one sign that he is not following the scientific method. Other trained ocean and zoological scientists, some of them on board previous plankton seeding tests run off government ships, have cautioned that carbon dioxide may not be reduced or not sequestered for the long term, or that other greenhouse gases like methane and nitrous oxide may be produced. The consensus of world scientists is that plankton seeding should not be done. Committees for conventions representing 192 countries recommended a moratorium on such activities. None of that deters Russ George. He's been certain of success, so certain that he pre-sold carbon credits even to the public online long before he captured any carbon dioxide. I can't find any indication that money was returned when George's company forests were not planted in Hungary as promised, or his ship the Weatherbird did not dump its iron, or his company went under. When we investigate the tangled web of corporations and corporate shells, all with different names, set up by Russ George, along with the convicted Canadian financier Nelson Skelbania, we become even more leery of George's claims. I have links to my previous two programs on Planktos and to the investigations by others in my Radio EcoShock blog for this week. Check that out at ecoshock.info.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
In fact, there are several versions of Russ George. The first is a tree planter, and his experience is strong there, there's no doubt about it. But you can also find Russ George in his persona as a self-taught nuclear scientist, expert, and businessman in the field of nuclear fusion. His company D2 Fusion sold stocks, which crashed, and promised products, which never appeared. On YouTube, there is a presentation by Dr. Russ George to the American Chemical Society in 1999. But Russ is no doctor. That's just his initials, D.R. George. Why doesn't he correct people who address him or post him as Dr. George, who think he must be one when they call him a senior scientist? In the old Masset Village presentation you heard earlier, Russ George was touted as the chief scientist on board the Ocean Pearl. That is misleading, I think. What is a scientist? In the 1800s, many scientists were gentlemen of leisure, investigating basic things. They made many important discoveries. But today, in a very complex world, we developed a university system which trains scientists and vets them. It takes many years to make a PhD doctor in any field. Russ attended the University of Utah for a few years and dropped out without a degree. That is, he is not a university graduate. Most people would find that surprising in the resume of a chief scientist. In another part of the definition of a modern scientist is the requirement to develop theories which are published in peer-reviewed journals after they've been tested. That is a check-and-balance system to make sure facts follow theory. As far as I can find out, Russ George has never been published in an accepted peer-reviewed journal. So he can make quite extraordinary statements, and the rest of the scientific community does not have to check them. None of this denies Russ George is an extraordinary man, even a brilliant one. I see him more as a kind of social and media artist with an ability to learn the language of scientific disciplines. He's also a visionary with the strength to inspire people, even a small village of people, on the wild side of the ocean. Visionaries have their limitations. Some believe in their vision 100% without any doubt or need to check with others.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. I'm going to play some Russ George clips from two telephone interviews done by Martin Lukacs. He's the reporter from the Guardian newspaper who broke this story. Both interviews are now posted online at archive.org in the public domain. If you listen, I guarantee you will begin to see Russ's vision, his point of view. You will learn about the ocean, and you risk not getting the whole picture. For example, let's start with this founding statement repeated often by Russ George over the years and given again in the PowerPoint provided by the old Masset Village for the Vancouver Press Conference. The slide says, quote, "Over the past half century, there has been a decline in atmospheric dust deposition from the deserts and dry lands of Asia, the most important season source of iron for the North Pacific Ocean," end quote. Really? I wondered if such a study had even been done. Looking in the references for these slides, we do find a paper, "Atmospheric Global Dust Cycle and Iron Inputs to the Ocean," by Natalie M. Mahwald of Cornell and a half dozen other world dust experts. I read the paper. It doesn't say anything about the decline of dust from Asia to the North Pacific. The paper is a key summary of all the top dust science, a survey to see what is known. It talks about research, and it looks at two important questions. Has chemistry of the industrial-laced air changed the availability of iron to plankton in the sea? And will climate change alter dust deposition? Baffled that I couldn't find anything about that claim in the paper, I wrote to Natalie Mahwald over the weekend. She gave me a helpful reply almost immediately. First I asked, is this dusty statement by Russ George and echoed by the Haida Village, is it true? Her reply, quote, probably not. More important than dust is soluble iron from Asia, which is likely to have increased, end quote. Second, I asked, could such a statement be derived from that paper? Answer, quote, I don't think there is anything in that paper on this. She adds, quote, there is almost no data describing the trends in dust coming from Asia over the whole 20th century. There is some evidence that dust maximized in the 1950s in the Chinese dust sources, but that is not true of all Asia, and that data is only available after 1950 or so. What is more important for ocean iron is the amount of soluble iron going into the ocean, not dust or total iron. Several studies have suggested that economic growth in Asia has substantially increased soluble iron inputs to the North Pacific by direct emission of soluble iron from anthropogenic emissions. or by supplying acids like sulfate, which make the dust iron more soluble. And we estimate from that an increase in North Pacific soluble iron inputs from the atmosphere deposition. In this region, sedimentary sources of iron are likely to be quite important, so that inputs from the atmosphere may not be driving phytoplankton growth. Thus, overall, I would say no, I do not agree that soluble iron inputs to the North Pacific have decreased over the 20th century, but rather have likely increased, but the uncertainty is large. End quote from a real dust scientist. So, what you say? Well, everything in the story of this ocean seeding experiment depends upon that fundamental statement that nature is not doing her job. Less dust is falling, the plankton are starving for iron, and that is why we must go out to sea and spend millions of dollars dumping iron into the ocean. But here we have their cited world expert saying that is probably not true. More iron may be available anyway due to industrial pollution. And the whole thing is not well known. There's a large uncertainty about it. With Russ George, you can be inspired if you want, but you have to check every detail of what he says. It's a heady cocktail of three-quarters truth, well worth listening to, I admit, and one-quarter exaggeration bordering on blarney.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Surely, we're not just dealing with volcanoes and dust when it comes to salmon decline in the North Pacific. It's a shame the old Massad village people couldn't wait for the upcoming release of the comprehensive report by the Cohen Inquiry into the disappearing sockeye salmon. In my opinion, and not only in my opinion, the old Massad village leaders are also over their heads. For example, during the press conference, two actual ocean scientists from the University of British Columbia were allowed one question each with no reply or comments by them. Note, there were no microphones for the press, just one mic for the presenters, carefully controlled by two of their lawyers who were present. Again, I wrote to one of the questioners, Métis Maldonado, a professor in the Earth, Ocean, and Sciences Department at UBC. She is also familiar with the fisheries on the Pacific coast and a Canada research chair in phytoplankton trace metal physiology. Métis says the Haida Salmon Restoration Project leaders were greatly oversimplifying a complex living system. After quoting from the 2010 paper by Ham et al. On the volcanic ash and anomalous plankton bloom of 2008, Métis concludes the bottom line is that yes, a volcanic eruption in 2008 enhanced phytoplankton production in the subarctic Pacific that summer and early fall, but no, there is no evidence to support that this phytoplankton bloom in August 2008 resulted in the high salmon returns of 2010. In fact, the non-scientist Russ George may have missed the target altogether on two counts. First of all, Ham et al. Says study of the volcanic eruption and plankton bloom, hardly any carbon dioxide was sequestered, quote, implying that even large-scale iron fertilization at an optimum time of year is not very efficient at sequestering atmospheric CO2. The opposite of what Russ George is telling us. Métis Maldonado adds other studies and citations showing the real cause of the sockeye salmon decline is still unknown to science. Their best guess does not focus on alleged starving salmon out at sea, but rather the growth conditions for juvenile salmon as they emerge from coastal waters. There is plenty of plankton for them there, and real scientific studies indicate there must be other factors in that nearshore environment affecting total long-term survival. Métis writes, quote, salmon survival has been linked to the quality of feeding and growing conditions during their early marine life, from smolt to adult, while the smolts are transitioning from the rivers to the open ocean. So the conditions in inlets and sounds are key, end quote. As our guest Karen Riston said earlier, this Haida Salmon Restoration Project may have only provided the salmon with a very expensive multi-million dollar lunch. Okay. It's time to play some Russ George reality, but as I hope I've shown, apply some healthy scientific doubt to everything. Russ George is talking with Guardian newspaper journalist Martin Lukacs. We'll start with, what was the rationality for secretly pouring iron into the ocean?
The proof has been is that, you know, that sort of confirms that the collapse of primary productivity in the North Pacific is catastrophic.
Mm. Right?
So if we don't do anything, we can expect to see that productivity continue to collapse into nothing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so the whole idea of the Haida people is that, you know, that somebody has to do, you have to try something, right? You can't just sit back and say, well, if we do nothing, Mother Nature will take care of itself. Well, no, she won't. Yeah. She'll simply die.
It would be possible to scale this up. Is that kind of the goal?
Well, sure. I mean, the goal is to, you know, this has got to be stewardship, right? So it's not a one-off thing. It has to happen. You know, since the fossil fuel age has caused a reduction of dust, which is killing the oceans, we need to replenish that dust. Mm-hmm. And we need to do it every year until we wean ourselves off of our carbon dioxide emission habit, right?
Okay.
And, you know, or face the consequences, right? The absolute certain consequence of high CO2 in the world is that our ocean dies.
How could a single Haida village perform geoengineering without getting any government permits? They claim they are the only government.
And get through all of the legal processes within the Haida Nation to make sure that the Haida Nation had to pass all of the appropriate legislative authority so that they could issue the appropriate, you know, ocean research permits and, you know, fisheries science permits and things so that everything was fully documented properly.
You mentioned earlier a little bit about the legal process that was followed to kind of ensure that this was done in a safe way. What exactly was the situation with the permits? These are permits that were given to you from the Haida Council,
about 10 years ago, the Supreme Court of Canada heard a case where the federal government of Canada took the Haida to court and challenged their claim of sovereignty.
Mm-hmm.
And the Supreme Court of Canada reviewed the case. It went all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, well, no colonial power nor Canada had ever declared war on the Haida and conquered them.
Mm-hmm.
And neither did the colonial government or the current government of Canada ever even deign to offer the Haida a treaty.
Mm-hmm.
And since those are the only two conditions under which the Haida could have lost their original sovereignty, right, is either by being conquered or by signing it over, they had an uninterrupted claim on sovereignty in their traditional territories equal to that of Canada.
This is the 2005 Haida case, right?
Yeah, right. And so, you know, based on that, you know, if, you know, the Haida have, you know, according to the Supreme Court of Canada, have an unchallengeable claim on their on sovereignty on their territory. So, but if you're going to carry on sort of sovereign activities, the way sovereign nations do that is they pass legislation,
mm-hmm.
right, that empowers their administrations to administer their laws, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, the band council the Haida Nation is basically formed. The Haida Nation is like Canada, right? It's sort of a federal provincial organization.
Mm-hmm.
So it has the Council of Haida Nation is the federal government of the Haida. And the two provinces are the village of Skidigit and the village of Old Massac.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so, and each of those, just like Canada, they, you know, the Canadian government sort of does external affairs and the provinces do internal affairs,
mm-hmm.
right? So resources are managed by the province, not by the Fed. And so in order for the Haida to manage their resources, they needed to pass the appropriate laws that said they ought to do that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And here was the mechanism. So the Old Massac Village Council, you know, wrote and passed the laws, and quite frankly, you know, there was a cut-and-paste job in substantial matter from the Canadian statutes. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So that they were identical in every way to what was in place in the parallel sovereign government of Canada. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And that empowered the Old Massac Village Council to administer this sovereign ocean territory. And so they did that. And part of what they did is then mapped that territory. So they drew the map of their world and declared their boundaries. And then the band council resolutions, which are their laws, specify that they should manage this in an appropriate way. And the way you manage research in the ocean and resources in the ocean is you demand a permit, you have a process and you issue permits. to do that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so all of that was done such that, you know, the end result of this is that the Haida Salmon Restoration Corporation was given all of the necessary and appropriate permits to do all the work that it needs to do,
mm-hmm.
right, to conduct this work, which is in keeping with what the international science community has said. This work on the oceans ought to be done under an appropriate mechanism, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Well-regulated mechanism and under permit and be science. And so, indeed, it has been,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's that. That's that story.
So because of these, because of Haida sovereignty, as you're saying, you never talked it over with the Canadian government, for instance.
Well, there was no, I mean, you know, we didn't talk it over with the French government or the Chinese government or anybody else, right?
Okay.
It was the sovereign affairs of the Haida.
Okay.
Right?
Okay.
So, you know, we actually did. I mean, we had Canadian government people who have been helping us. You know, we're funded by the National Research Council of Canada. We've been, you know, given, you know, help and had workshops run on that we've been invited to teach us how to use satellite resources by the Canadian Space Agency. You know, we're, you know, within the federal, you know, we get lots of support from Canadian agencies because we're sort of simultaneously both Haida and Canadian, right?
Okay.
But you choose your, you know, you choose your regulators, right? And if you only need to go to one regulator, then you go to that one, right? Nobody seeks extra bureaucracy, right?
Right. Can you?
So we had all the, you know, with the authority of the Supreme Court of Canada, we went to the bureaucracy that was easiest for us to work with, which is the Haida bureaucracy, right?
So who would have the kind of like copies of those permits? Would that be?
Oh, that they're hanging on the wall on my office.
Okay.
In the office here in Vancouver, yeah.
Okay, oh, that's where you're located. You're located in Vancouver.
Well, we have offices at Old Macedon, but our research office, business office, is here in Vancouver.
Okay.
Who were the scientists on board? I asked that question at the press conference. At first, they dodged it, claiming privacy issues, then gave me a very short list. Here is that exchange.
Alex Smith from CFRO Radio.
Please name the scientists who were on board the Ocean Pearl for this project. You mentioned some.
The question is, name the scientists on board the fishing vessel Ocean Pearl. Jason is the operations officer, and I know he spent many weeks at sea, and it was really sunny once in the 4 weeks, I think, and there was only a 30-foot groundswell happening. So, Jason?
Hi. We had a number of scientists. We had a number of scientists on board. Obviously, Russ George was one of our key scientists. I don't have their CVs with me.
I think there's a question of privacy of individuals. We'll get you that information. And on the video that's on here, you'll see the deckhands and the technicians that are walking around trying to deploy equipment in sea. So there was lots of people. I think we can get that information. It's not a guess. We don't want to guess here.
So you're not answering the question?
No, I'm saying we have Russ George was our chief scientist, right? We've got Peter Gross, who's our senior oceanographic engineer. He's also doubles as our sonar expert. We had plankton biologist on board named Tegan Syme. We have chemists on board. I did some of the chemistry work. And we had a number of technicians. A lot of our work was collaborative. And so a lot of the technical work was done on the ship.
Asked the same question by journalist Martin Lukacs, Russ George replied with a very short list, long on Baffelgab.
Can you tell me a little bit about the scientific team that got put together for this? Who are the other scientists who have been involved with the project?
Well, mostly people that we hire, you know, who are on staff in the company, right?
Okay.
And so, you know, we have an Australian zooplankton taxonomist, right? And we have a Canadian sonar expert who's working with our multi-frequency sonar system.
Okay.
and you know, and a bunch of other, and other Canadians and stuff like that, right? So, you know, in different disciplines, you know, ocean chemistry, physical oceanography, chemistry, chemical oceanography, biological oceanography, physical oceanography, right? Are sort of the three principal disciplines. So we have people in all those, representing all those disciplines for it.
All the crew were undergrads. With Russ George as the supposed chief scientist, they had minimal training in high-tech equipment on board, and at one point required direct coaching by satellite by Professor Doug Campbell at Mount Allison University. Several of the crew listed their qualifications online as technical geeks with things like audio as their specialty. Sorry, I've gone through the crew list from multiple sources. There was not a single doctorate scientist on the ship. Why does this matter? It all has to do with confidence in the gathering methods and the chain of custody. At the press conference, we were told Russ George was not present because he was too busy analyzing data. Nobody really bought that. There was a bit of a hush in the room. So Russ George, whose record we know too well, is in charge of all that data? John Disney told the press, some of the data would be released for verification by independent parties. Will only supportive data be released? Who knows? Russ George bragged to one reporter that 100 PhD doctorates would emerge out of the data he had collected, the Golden Mountain. I doubt it. Who will trust it? Russ George denies there is any convention or even a moratorium against ocean fertilization.
And I imagine there are some critics who will say that this is in violation of the United Nations CBD moratorium or the London Convention. What would be your response to that?
Well, our legal team that we hired, which are the best legal maritime and environmental law team in Canada, have examined all of that. And in fact, that is a sort of a mythology that there is a moratorium. There are recommendations to create such things, but nothing has been implemented of that nature. Mm-hmm. You know, those people who have promoted that have spun it as if the recommendations from committees for the international community to implement such things is a done deal. It is not at all.
Well, maybe Russ George is right about this. Maybe the holes in international law are so big that every village, encountering hard times anywhere around the world, can start out to change the whole earth to suit themselves. This Haida Salmon Restoration Project is a wake-up call to governments to act before it is too late, to at least regulate with criminal penalties rogue geoengineering. We manage to investigate and penalize pedophiles no matter where the act takes place, but not unilateral changes to the species, to the biosphere, to the ocean? Meanwhile, Russ George continues his pursuit of fame and recognition. Here he is, off to the World Bank, to the World Food and Agriculture Organization in Rome. Who is paying for those travels? The poor of Old Masset Village for the next 10 years? But don't worry, Russ George is 100% certain their experiment has disproven all other scientific fears.
Well, it's interesting to see that the climate director of the World Wildlife Fund now says, you know, this is the thing to do. Whereas in those times he was saying if they issued press release after press release vilifying me and that project. And now it's their idea. Thank you. You know, that's a matter of record, right? Well, you know, somebody told me the other day, you know, that science, that new discoveries in science goes through three stages. It goes through ridicule, anger, and then claim that it's their idea.
Yeah.
And we've certainly, this topic has been ridiculed for decades. You know, I mean, John Martin's good name has been ridiculed for coming up with this in the 1980s. And in fact, he's the, you know, this wouldn't have happened without his incredible wisdom and insight. And he was right, right? We've proved him right. So, you know, the time where people want to argue, you know, the critics of this who are people who are criticizing based on theory, not on experimental fact, have tried to prevent any facts from being obtained, right? You know, the efforts of the group that have tried to block this with, you know, by creating these London Protocol, all these efforts, they haven't been out to discover the fact. They've been, their tactic has said, do not allow knowledge on this subject to be gathered. That's what they said. There should be a ban on scientific inquiry into this. And so, and of course that allows their theoretical position to stand as equal to the two people with facts, right? If you deny facts, then it's one theory versus another. Well, now the facts are on the table, unquestionably. Does this change the oxygen level in the ocean and produce dead zones? No. We have thousands of oxygen measurements from top to bottom everywhere, inside our plankton bloom, outside our plankton bloom, inside other plankton blooms, outside other plankton blooms, everywhere from Vancouver north, right, we measured oxygen. Nowhere did we see in a plankton bloom a diminishment of oxygen sufficient to threaten any form of sea life from top to bottom. So the idea that plankton blooms will deplete oxygen in the water, in the ocean, especially in the pelagic ocean, absolutely false. Best data set ever gathered in the world, absolutely conclusive to that fact, right?
There is no absolute certainty in science. Russ George can offer it to us, just as he offered absolution to the Vatican for their carbon sins, and he never delivered on that either. You can't make this stuff up in Hollywood. But I did say Russ was often right, and he can be worth listening to. Here he tells us our personal carbon pollution is killing the ocean far more than overfishing.
Our fishing industries are catching the last of the fish, right? The last of the few animals that can survive on these dwindling pastures that have lost their carrying capacity. We're fishing and catching the last of the fish there, which we call overfishing, right? But by far the greatest factor in fisheries decline on this planet is not the overfishing of the last of the fish. It's the killing of the carrying capacity of the pasture, carry the fish, right? So, you know, around the world where fish are collapsing, you know, the evidence has been very clear in ocean science that the collapse of ocean productivity inevitably leads to fewer fish, right? You know, the view of much of the world is, well, let's point our finger at the usual suspects, which is those nasty fishermen, right? When it was actually me and you and I. It's the carbon dioxide that you and I have contributed to the atmosphere of the planet through our day-to-day life that has resulted in the collapse of ocean productivity.
Russ George is also right to warn us the oceans are dying and that climate change is the major cause, and I hope that he can get that message out further. Intelligent or not, though, I can't follow Russ George or the Haida villagers to their ultimate goal. Saying the ocean is dying, George tells us humans must take over these last wild places on Earth. We'll convert the open ocean into pastures, like an agribusiness on the seas, farming plankton and the fish. We'll dump iron every year. Maybe we'll introduce new genetically modified species, I'm thinking. Who knows? The dying ocean is ours to play with and command. Russ George speaks with Martin Lukacs.
You know, this is not a one-off project, right? The ocean is not saved by, you know, the ocean pastures don't change from being wildernesses where we hunt wild things to pastures where we take, where we steward them in a single project. So, you know, the Haida people, you know, we had Haida people on board and in the office, and they're learning how to do this with us, right? And so a major part of this project is an on-the-job training for the people of Old Massa, so because they need to take this on, and they understand that they need to go to sea every year and take care of their pasture, right? And if they don't do that, then the inevitable consequence of the trillion tons of carbon dioxide already emitted into the planet's atmosphere, of which a third of it has been absorbed into the ocean, and two-thirds is still yet to be absorbed. And this is regardless of whether we emit one more molecule of CO2. Like, this is yesterday's CO2 is demonstrably a lethal dose of carbon dioxide for the ocean pastures.
Is that your vision for the seas? It's not mine. I'm Alex Smith. My thanks to Martin Lukacs of The Guardian for putting his reporter's audio notes into the public domain. Be sure and check out the detailed blog for this program at ecoshock.info. I've got lots of links for you there. Download this program as a free MP3 from our website at ecoshock.org. Thank you for listening, and join me again next week.